Criminal Law Revision Commission meeting on Saturday, July 19th, room 315 Capitol. On the agenda today is sex offenses preliminary draft number one. And that is all.
We have a seminar at the University of Michigan. And my attendance participation in this conference was through the good offices of the Law Enforcement Planning Office, the Governor's Office. They had arranged it for me. They paid my expenses, my tuition, took care of the whole thing through the law enforcement planning funds. The seminar was handled and conducted under the joint sponsorship of the Institute of Continuing Legal Education and the Council of State Governments. And since it was held at the University of Michigan, it was largely oriented around the Michigan Criminal Code Revision. The principal speakers we had, principal instructors, as it probably would be a better way of referring to them.
Pardon me, Don. Don is just telling us about the reporting on the conference that he attended.
The principal lecturers and coordinators for the program were Professor George and Professor Israel from the University of Michigan Law School. And these two gentlemen were the chief reporters for the Michigan Criminal Code Revision Project. And had worked on their project from its inception to the final publication of their approved tentative draft. And particularly with respect to the Michigan experience, I thought that in addition to the materials I had circulated to you about the workshop sessions and whatnot, it would probably be a good idea to spend a few minutes to give you a little background on what their experience was, because I think we can certainly benefit from it. Before I get to that, I should mention that there were about 16 states represented. Total enrollment there was about 26 people. Mainly states from the Eastern Seaboard and the South and the Midwest were represented. And it was interesting to see that although the objectives of all the states with respect to criminal code revision are basically the same, that the approaches vary quite a bit. In fact, almost a different structure in LISHA for each state. Ours probably resembles our organizational structure. The commission probably resembles, except for the size of it, Michigan more than any others. Some of the states are handling it through their legislative council's office on a long-term, long-range basis. Because talking with people from those types of offices, their problem has been that they are called upon to do so many other things that they can't keep a concerted program going on code revision. So they're sort of an open-end project in many states. They don't know just when they're going to finish it. But the state of Texas probably has the loosest organization. They have for each article they're drafting, and they're following the model penal code, incidentally. Although they're departing therefrom, certain instances of, like they have a crime against communism, statute for communism, state law. And they're the only ones I found that had such a statute. But they are handling theirs through the bar, and for each article, they've assigned a different individual to draft the article. And they have been working on their program for over 4 years now, and they're probably about halfway through now on substance. And the problem is, of course, that they don't have any way of controlling their timetable. And also, they're having some difficulties in getting a consistent effort have about as many different approaches as we have grassroots in this kind of a project. Although the benefit of that kind of a program is that you get a good cross section of the bar working on it. But in addition to the Michigan people, we had Bert Agata from the University of Houston, and he's the senior counsel on the National Commission to rewrite the federal criminal statutes. And I mentioned this in subcommittee yesterday. It was really interesting to listen to how they're progressing on their proposal. They will have a draft ready by November, they think, a study draft of completely new Title 18, which will hopefully, they say, will encompass all of the felony federal crime, and try to get in as many of the misdemeanors as possible. They recognize there will be some misdemeanors left out of the Title 18. Their approach is to use the same sources that the states are drawing on. That is the Model Penal Code, the New York proposal, and the Michigan proposal, and to try to make the federal criminal statutes as near in form and substance as it can make them to the state provisions. And they showed us some of their early drafts, and they read much like our drafts, or much like the New York proposals, except that they, for each crime, after they will state the, make a definitive statement of the crime, then they will have, say, 7 or 8 or 10 bases for federal jurisdiction that they'll tack on to. They will be circulating this. We should have a copy of it this fall sometime. I think it should be real helpful to us to have that material. Their program is supposed to expire beginning of next year, but they feel it's going to be extended for another 2 years. We also had Professor Allen from the University of Michigan Law School, and he was formerly with the Illinois Criminal Code Revision Project. And of course, Illinois ran into a number of problems in their project, but as it turned out, finally got the job done. Probably of more interest, I felt, was a statement made by Roy Proffitt. He's also at Michigan Law School now, and he was formerly the technical advisor for the Missouri Senate Criminal Law Revision Committee. And this was an early project. This arose out of the Kefauver investigations. And after the Kefauver Committee had appeared in Illinois, and the state legislature became concerned about vice and gambling and whatnot, they set up a special committee through the state senate to reform certain areas of the law, mainly gambling and narcotics and vice. And once they got into it, then they decided they would try to expand it and make it a complete criminal code revision. Well, they got about halfway through, and they had about 60 bills that were eventually enacted in the law in Missouri. But one thing that stuck in my mind, he said, that in view of the number of discussions we've had in the past about our commentary, was that it was very gratifying to them afterwards, after some of their proposals had been enacted into law, to see that the Missouri Supreme Court followed their commentary almost right down the line in destroying their statutes, made great use of it, and their opinions comment upon the commentary. Great example. And so he stressed the value of the commentary, although he recognized that, and I agreed with him here certainly, that you shouldn't put something in the commentary if you think it belongs in the statute, if you're that unsure about it. But he said that don't underestimate the need of and the value of the commentary on your proposal. We also had a good talk from Wayne LaFave. He's a law professor from the University of Illinois and has been a reporter on the Minimum Standards Project of the American Bar Association. And most of their work has been on procedure. And they're a little discouraged because in some of the areas that they worked on, they felt they were really reaching and they were having all these progressive suggestions, some of which by the time they were printed are obsolete because of decisions of the Supreme Court. So they're going to have to go back through it and try to amend it. Now, Saul Rubin was there also. Now, he talked with us, as you know, when we were first getting started. And he's still beating the same drum as far as sentencing and whatnot is concerned. He indicated that in light of the American Bar Association's proposal on sentencing, not that they agree with them wholeheartedly on what they suggest, but they are planning very shortly to undertake a revision of the Model Sentencing Act. And they don't know yet just when it would be available, but they expect to start work. Mr. Rubin said he would be starting work, he felt, within the next few months. Because they feel that proposals are not explicit enough in light of recommendations of the ADA. But he said something that was extremely interesting, I thought, and I think very valid, and that is that in structuring your sentencing provisions, and the way he put it, he compared Michigan with New York, for example. And he said that he felt the Michigan proposals on sentencing would have far greater effect in improving the administration of justice in the state of Michigan because of the mandatory nature of it. In other words, that it spells out clearly what the options of the court are and who's going to do what, how the corrections division is going to operate. Whereas he felt that the New York proposal was too loose and really would not have too much effect on what he called a bad penal system in the state of New York. But the workshop discussions on sentencing boil down pretty much to this, that we need to examine certainly the Model Sentencing Act, we need to examine the ADA proposals, and whatever kind of penalty structure we come up with to fit in with our grading provisions. And he felt that it didn't make any difference, for example, whether you had 10 classes of felonies or 3, as long as that the options that were available and the mandatory or the maximum sentences were clearly spelled out in your statutes. Although most of the people there felt that there wasn't much point in having more than, say, 3 or 4 classes of felonies, for example. But that was not the controlling factor. The really important aspect of it is that you clearly indicated within each of these subdivisions, each classification, what the outer limits are, what the outer limits would be with each individual. And I think that the general consensus is that in drafting a grading and sentencing structure, the emphasis should be on the individual offender rather than the crime. And concerned not so much with the crime that's committed, although that's an important consideration, obviously, when crimes are more serious than others, but that in grading and structuring your provisions, that the court has ample opportunity to evaluate the individual offender, not to lock the court in on a fixed sentencing and grading structure. Peter Lowe, also a professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School, who had formerly acted as a reporter for the Bar Project on Minimum Standards, also spoke and discussed their approach and what they felt the minimum standards should be, although everyone felt, and Lowe and the others who worked on the Bar Project seemed to feel that they would like to see as many states incorporate as many of these suggestions as possible. At the same time, the general feeling among the participants there was that we shouldn't try to buy this as a package. It's not designed, and nor are the states expected to buy this as a package. They do have pilot projects going in three states now. I can't recall which states those are offhand. I've got notes. But there are three states in which they are attempting to integrate step by step the proposals of the minimum standard project into a criminal code revision project to see what the reaction will be in the various states. One of those states, I believe, is, as I recall, is Texas. Another one is Florida. I'm not certain on that. Just a couple more minutes on the Michigan project, and it's very appropriate today since we'll be discussing sex offenses. The Michigan proposal was submitted to the legislature for the fall session last year, and they had a rather a huge organization of people in this Michigan project, although the actual number of working members was about 30. But the way it was structured, it was set up through the bar, and there were no legislative members on the committee, which was their first mistake.
Oh yeah.
That's not always a help. What else for the old Constitution.
But what had happened? They ran into some difficulties there. I'll mention that later. They didn't have any legislative members on the committee. The Michigan Supreme Court was contacted, and their participation in the project was solicited. But the Supreme Court felt that it wouldn't be ethical or proper for them to participate in writing laws and being able to ultimately construe. So they said, all right, well, we won't expect that then. But they did try to keep the Supreme Court advised as they went along. They had a judicial committee in the state senate. In the state bar, a very large committee that did not was not brought in at the planning stages of the Michigan project, and so they received quite a bit of adverse criticism early in the meeting from this committee. So, in order to pacify them a little bit, they made all of them members of their committee. So, as you look into the Michigan proposal, you'll see about four pages just listing the people. Well, all these people are, many of them are just there in name only, just so that they would be brought in by associations so they wouldn't oppose the project. But they had their drafting committee that consisted of about 15 people. What had happened just before they introduced their proposal to the session of the Michigan legislature, they called a press conference to announce their proposals. They invited people from all over the state to be there, and Professor George Andrew there, and Judge Gilmore, Circuit Judge in Detroit, who was chairman of the commission, was there. And they issued a press release and had a press conference on the proposal. And there was an individual, a reporter from the Detroit Free Press, who was there. And his first contact with their code. He zeroed in on sex offenses and abortion. They had an abortion proposal, which was very similar to the one that passed the Oregon last session. They had proposed to liberalize the abortion laws. They had proposed to eliminate adultery as a crime in the state. They had proposed to eliminate as a crime any kind of consensual adult sexual activity. Rather sensational kind of story by this reporter in the papers. The legislature sat tight on it. On top of that, one of the judges from the Supreme Court decided he didn't like the quote and he lobbied actively against it. They also ran into a problem that the legislature was very actively working on a court revision reform bill. Senate Judiciary Committee had all this to worry about, and they said, we don't want to fuss with this criminal code. And so besides that, we don't like it all, you know, you're turning all these sex fiends loose in the street. But they said it got so bad that, that even their wives, you know, were on their backs when they went home. What are you doing to us? You know, our children will be safe. So what they did, they backed off, and they put adultery back in as a crime, compromised and said, okay, we'll only be a misdemeanor now. They put sodomy back in as in its traditional form, only they reduced it to a misdemeanor, unless there is force or a minor fault. So that's back in the code. They took their abortion part out of the code, and so they've got the same old abortion law. The legislature will be convening again in fall session this fall, and they expect that their chances are much better of passage this time. I think that they learned a lot. But we had a you might be interested in this. I thought it was a pretty good commentary on the foresight of this legislature when it set up this particular commission. That as a result of the workshop sessions and discussing all the different states and their approaches and the Michigan approach and the New York approach, the consensus was, number one, that pretty much the ideal size for a commission or a committee would be from 13 to 15 members. Secondly, that you should have a good, healthy representation from your state legislature on the committee for those commissions if at all possible. Secondly, that you should have other individuals on there like district attorneys and attorney general and public members. In other words, it came that down to you could almost read our act and set up our commission and say that we were pretty close with what they seemed to feel was a good working type commission on a project like this. Well, we really had a good session, I felt. It was a working conference. We started at 9 o'clock in the morning and we'd work until 12. We'd be off for an hour and come back and we'd work till 5. And we did this in 5 straight days, and there's not a lot of material to cover, but they did an excellent job. And I think as we go along, I don't think there's much point spending any more time on it right now, but as we go along, I think some of the information I picked up there will be of great help to us. Some of the contacts that we will make through these other states, I think there's going to be a good interchange or better interchange among the states now that are working on similar projects, so we can keep abreast of what everybody else is doing a little better. But the feeling was that, and I think this was emphasized and brought out by this federal project, that there's nothing wrong, and there's nothing to be ashamed of in trying to be as uniform in your approaches as possible. And as you get into an area, that it's just smart and an intelligent approach to say, well, let's look at the model penal code and let's look at these other states, and if we like it and we want to change our law, let's adopt it. If not, let's reject it. But if at all possible to have as much uniformity in the substantive crimes and in the procedures as you possibly can. Certainly you have the advantage later on as these proposals become law of drawing upon the court decisions of other states. This is what motivated Michigan a great deal. Of course, Michigan, understandably, is a lot closer to New York than we are geographically, certainly. But the federal project is drawing on the model penal code of these other states, and I think that understandably, we're going to have individual differences from one state to the next, but if we can attempt to get as much uniformity in this as possible, I think it's going to be a great benefit later on. All right, that's about all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions of Don, Bob?
Not a question, but I have to listen to it.
Comment?
Listening to his tale of horrors in Michigan, I might have a suggestion. May not know there are about 4 or 5 nuclear energy power plants proposed to the state in the next 5, 6, 7 years. And when you mention nuclear energy, people's maybe they think of a white room cloud hanging over the peaceful environs of Lebanon or someplace like that. There's nothing to worry about. And so half a dozen of us in our business were concerned about these possibilities and so forth, got together or scheduled a seminar yesterday at Oregon State with the nuclear radiation lab people, and sent out a general invitation to newspaper and radio and television people around the state, expected to get at the most a dozen men there, and we had about 45. We underestimated the willingness of people to spend their time and money to come over there and learn something about the field. It seemed to me that points out this thing Don mentioned about the first contact with code that anybody had outside of the in-group was the reporter from the Free Press who was in a hurry to get a lead for a story and picked on sex offenses. I can understand how reporters do it and sympathize with him and not greatly criticize him. Of course, I know in this state the legislature doesn't get upset because of what it sees in newspapers, so it gets away from that other problem that you mentioned. But it would seem to me well in advance of this proposal that things somewhat similar to what we carried on yesterday would be pretty useful. I can think of offhand of a dozen newspapers, radio stations, television stations which would be interested, I think, in sponsoring some sort of arrangement with this commission, whether people can spend a day and get some idea of the basics of what we're trying to do and so forth before we handle a bunch of specific statutes saying that we're saying in effect that adultery is no longer a crime in Oregon or something of this sort. Basically what our philosophy is and what we're trying to do. And I think that if we do that in advance of the time code presented to them, not too long so they forget it, but somewhat in advance of it, I think it saves us a great deal of trouble.
You know, they didn't do that in the probate code. Of course, they met throughout the state with attorneys, but I don't think there was any public exposure as far as the citizenry was concerned at all.
Still hasn't been.
No, and there are very few lawyers know what's in that new probate code throughout the state. But the point that I was making is that it whistled through pretty easily.
That's different than criminal law.
Yeah, that's true.
And the only objections I heard to it were from people in the newsroom business who were afraid they were going to lose legal advertisements. Really?
Yeah, that's about
the strongest objection you heard to probate. And
we did compromise there. We extended the time of publication beyond what the original code was.
I'm going to write a new publication bill for you for the next session. We'll save the people some money.
We're going to amend it already?
No, just on general and legal publication. I don't see any reason why these outfits should charge you more than the going rate they charge other advertisers, and they all do. Sets a statute that it's higher price if the automobile dealer wants to come in by the same amount of space and get it for less. And it's crazy.
Any further comments? Okay, we were supposed to have considered the section on responsibility today, but George Platt still has laryngitis to the extent where he can hardly talk. Isn't that right, Don?
Yeah, his voice is practically gone.
So Don suggested that we consider the very interesting field of sexual conduct. Or sex offenses. Do you want to take over from there, Don?
Yeah, we had a lot of fun in subcommittee with this draft.
You I engaged in the conduct, but I'm not sure it's offensive.
Incidentally, the draft was originally prepared by Gene, what's her name?
Lavorato.
Lavorato. And she had a lot of fun preparing it, too.
It was interesting. I don't know if it was just coincidental, but shortly after she spent a couple of months working on this sex offenses draft, she got married.
I do have one question, if I may revert to the other thing. Judge Berg wanted it. How did the Texas people, this conference, feel about oil depletion allowances?
Well, we had discussed that.
That's not a crime, is that?
They really have some
good people working on that project. I hope I didn't give you the wrong impression. They worked long and hard on it. And, pretty limited budget. We do have a draft of the Texas proposal, incidentally, but when they printed it, they didn't put any commentary with it, so it really, except for seeing what they've done, you really don't know why they did it.
Now let's get on to the sex.
Now, incidentally, for any of those who are here today, that we weren't able to notify the last minute yesterday about the change in agenda, I want to apologize. We tried to contact as many people as we could and let them know that the responsibility wouldn't be considered today.
Substitute sex for responsibility.
But our minutes of the subcommittee on this subject probably received the most extensive editing.
Thank you.
But seriously, on this, this is probably, without question, the most sensitive area, the substantive criminal code that we'll be dealing with. As I mentioned, the Michigan experience bears it out. These are politically touchy areas, and we recognize this. And when we were working on the early draft of this, we felt this, that we would, if we're going to propose an up-to-date and a forward-looking criminal code, that regardless of what decision this commission might take ultimately, as far as the staff was concerned, we reported that we would not be doing our job and fulfilling our responsibility to the commission if we did not present to you what seems to be the trend in the law. Not only the trend in this country, but it has been the trend for some time in other countries. And that is to finally recognize that in the area of sex offenses, and I think Lou Johnson put it very well in connection with another draft that we were considering in the subcommittee a couple weeks ago, that the attempts of the states and the legislatures throughout the years to legislate morality have been abysmal failures. And I think that the model penal code people, the American Law Institute, recognize this. And I think that the states that are working and have worked recently on criminal code revisions have recognized this. That you're kidding yourself to a great extent to think that just because you don't approve of something from a moral standpoint or an ethical standpoint, that making it a crime and usually a felony is going to cure it. Of course, this is the big change that this draft here today makes in our existing law. It says, in effect, private, consensual, sexual activity, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual, between consenting adults, is not a criminal. And specifically spelled out in connection with spouses. What a man and a woman do in the sanctity of their bedroom or wherever else they do it, in their own home, it's their business and it's no business. States.
Having been licensed by the state to occupy that bedroom.
So that's the basic underlying premise of this draft. Now, I think the introductory material is very good. I'd like to go through that briefly with you, beginning on the first page of the draft. Drafting the article on sex offenses, careful consideration was given to the broad scope of personal, family, community, and religious interests which are or may be affected by sexual activities. While many valuable interests exist, only a few were deemed sufficiently vital to warrant criminal sanctions for their protection. Specifically, the interests sought to be protected in the sexual offenses article are as follows. 1. Protection of the individual. adult as well as child, against all non-consensual and forceful acts. 2, protection of the young and immature from the sexual advances of older, more mature individuals. However, the proposed draft is not intended to proscribe the following conduct. 1, any sexual activities engaged in between spouses. 2, any sexual conduct engaged in between consenting adults, whether of a heterosexual or a homosexual nature. And in that connection, the draft, in effect, repeals the law of making adultery a crime. It would repeal the law of making fornication a crime. And as far as, and it would change our sodomy statutes in that consensual adult activity would no longer be criminal. 3, any consensual sexual activities engaged in by adolescents where the parties involved are within 4 years of age of each other. All of the offenses described in this article require that the prescribed conduct be committed upon the victim without his consent. The proposed draft includes the following provisions. Definition of terms, provisions generally applicable to the sex offenses article. 3, rape, 3 degrees of rape. Sodomy, 3 degrees, and a crime called sexual abuse, 2 degrees. The sections relating to rape, sodomy, and sexual abuse are divided into ascending degrees on the basis of the following factors. The age of the victim and the age of the actor, or the mental or physical condition of the victim, or the use of force or threats. Basically, the draft seeks to increase the liability of the adult actor in proportion to the abnormality of his conduct, while at the same time limiting the liability of the youthful offender who is close to the age of his alleged victim. As with previous drafts of specific crimes, no penalty sections are included, and they will be incorporated into the draft when all the offenses are graded by the commission. Now, at this point, I should mention, too, that in your books, you should have the basic draft itself, and you should also have separately the amendments to the draft that were proposed by the subcommittee at its meeting on May 3rd, 1969.
There's only the reported notes are going to become part of this page of it. Can prescribe the following conduct to any sexual conduct selling into adults, so forth. I presume this means that in the case of consenting adults, that each must be of sufficient mental capacity to give consent.
Who was the chairman of that company?
Representing Carson.
The one with the glare on his face.
Yeah. The real man down the corner.
I was just saying, Carolina was not a member of that subcommittee at that time.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over back to Don. He's been through it 3 more times, and the glare disappears more times through it. So I'm not getting too quicker either.
Now, I think if we can get, you're a little stymied on your vocabulary on this, because everything you say seems to have a double meaning for some reason. But we can get a broad overview on this draft.
Come on, get them there.
We're right through it. Well, we had so much laughter in our minutes of our subcommittee, it's a little difficult to transcribe something.
You did burn those tapes.
So we'll go through the definitions first, but I'd like to go right on through so you can see how these are applied, then we can come back. That's all right. All right, definitions. Section 1, sub 1, sexual intercourse has its ordinary meaning and occurs upon any penetration, however slight. Submission is not required. 2, deviant sexual intercourse means conduct between persons not married to each other, consisting of contact between the sex organs of one person and the mouth or anus of another. Sexual contact means any touching of the sexual or other intimate parts of a person not married to the actor for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of either party. Four, mentally defective means that a person suffers from a mental disease or defect which renders him incapable of appraising the nature of his conduct. Five, mentally incapacitated means that a person is rendered temporarily incapable of appraising or controlling his conduct owing to the influence of a narcotic or intoxicating substance administered to him without his consent or to any other act committed upon him without his consent. I think four, five, and six, and seven also, I think, are directed at your questions. Six, physically helpless means that a person is unconscious or for any other reason is physically unable to communicate unwillingness to an act. Seven, forcible compulsion means physical force that overcomes earnest resistance or a threat expressed or implied that places a person in fear of immediate death or serious physical injury to himself or another person, or in fear that he or another person will immediately be kidnapped. Now, as the commentary points out, these are the basic definitions that will apply through the rest of the draft. Now, subsection 2, I think there's some discussion at the outset. It's designed to remove any uncertainty as to what conduct falls within the meaning of deviant sexual intercourse. Deviant sexual intercourse includes all acts of anal or oral intercourse, fellatio, cunnilingus, and sodomy between human beings, but does not include intercourse with animals, bestiality, or with dead bodies, necrophilia.
Where are you reading that?
This is on page 3. Page 3 of your commentary. Alright, now if we could move back over, or move over now to page 4, getting into section 2. Provisions generally applicable to the article on sexual offenses.
Excuse me, I didn't want to answer the question, but I don't know when it's the proper time to do something, Mr. Chairman.
Don, when you...
Oh, I don't care. However you want to do it. I was thinking that if it's on the definition itself, that I think it's a little easier to see how they fit into the sections, because sometimes I think we answer the question if we get to the section they're used in. All right, lack of consent. This is the bottom of page 4, sub 1, section 2. Whether or not specifically stated, it is an element of every offense defined in this article that the sexual act was committed without consent of the victim. A person is deemed incapable of consenting to a sexual act when he is A, less than 16 years of age, or B, mentally defective, or C, mentally incapacitated, or D, physically helpless. Subsection 2, mistake as to age.
But now, does this incorporate the amendments? I noticed the amendments.
Well, I think our First Amendment comes into sub 2 there on
right.
First one. Right. Now, that'll be on your amendments in the separate part of your book there.
Just ahead of
it. Yeah, mistake as to age. In any prosecution under this article, which the criminality of conduct depends on a child being below the age of, now the original draft said 10, your amendment changes this to 12. Now the section as amended, there also is some new language with respect to the burden of proof. Now mistake as to age on your amendments, first page in your book, page 5, subsection 2 of section 2 is amended to read as follows. Mistake as to age. In any prosecution under this article in which the criminality of conduct depends on the child being below the age of 12, the subcommittee felt that they have higher age there. It is no defense that the actor did not know the child's age or that he reasonably believed the child to be older than the age of 12. But when criminality depends on the child's being below a specified age other than 12, it is above 12. It is a defense for the act to prove by preponderance of the evidence that he reasonably believed the child to be above the specified age at the time of the act giving rise to the charge. What that says is that if you're below 12, that doesn't make any difference whether he was mistaken or not. If this is looked upon as such abnormal conduct, and the danger to the victim is so great that no defense should be recognized for a reasonable mistake as to the age. But if it's above 12 there is a reasonable mistake and the defendant can prove that by preponderance of the evidence, then it should be a defense to the crime. Now, this is subsection 3. Subsection 3 is amended. The amended version reads as follows. Mistake as to consent. In any prosecution under this article in which the victim's lack of consent is based solely upon his incapacity to consent because he was mentally defective, mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless, it is a defense for the actor to prove by preponderance of the evidence that at the time he engaged in the conduct constituting the offense, he did not know of the facts or conditions responsible for such incapacity to consent. And those are the only changes on page 5. Moving down to subsection 4, spouse relationships. Whenever in this article the definition of an offense excludes conduct with the spouse, the exclusion extends to persons living as man and wife, regardless of the legal status of their relationship. The exclusion is inoperative as respects spouses living apart under a decree of judicial separation. For the definition of an offense excludes conduct with the spouse, this does not preclude conviction of the spouse as an accomplice in a sexual act which he causes another person not within the exclusion to perform.
Do you mean in subsection 4 to use the word decree?
Make that order to.
Right. Yeah. What about the preliminary order?
Yeah.
When the problems come about, is
order or decree?
I think that's correct.
Order or?
Yeah.
Order or decree? Yeah, I don't think.
Is there a motion to that effect?
Sure.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion's carried.
All right. Sexually promiscuous complainants.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I switch there. Are we accomplishing more than we really want to there? Suppose you find a suggestion that if they're living apart under a decree, that isn't comprehended within the term order. In other words, are you, by using the term order, might you not run the risk of having someone contend that where it is a final document called a decree, that isn't what
you mean? You get order or decree.
You get order or.
Oh, excuse me, order or decree.
Prosecution under sections 3, 4, sub 2, 6, 7, 2, 9, and 10 2 of this article, it is a defense for the actor to prove that the alleged victim was prior to the time of the offense charge prostitute. Now, this will have to be examined with each of these sections as we get into it.
I mean, at any time. At any time, in the past.
Well, the intent is not to zero in on the prostitutes, but to limit sexual promiscuity, to get them out of it as a defense.
And I think Bob's referring to a born prostitute.
Yeah, prostitutes grow up and get married, you know.
Well, I suppose that'd go to the way of the evidence.
Graduate prostitute. Well, yeah, fine prostitute.
I heard a whole hour of arguing in the Supreme Court over what a prostitute was.
What you really mean is a prostitute at the time of the act.
No, he doesn't, because he says prior to the time of the charge of prostitute. Once she's been a prostitute, she's no longer under any protection of the law.
According to the stories that are consistent, a substantial number of the grandmothers of Eastern Oregon had some professional experience prior to their marriage.
I've never heard that.
Of course, you can't really evaluate this without looking at each specific section.
Yeah, let's look and see what sections we're talking about.
3 and 4 are raised.
Is this called the Gold Plain Defense?
Now I see on page 10, it's page 5, it says this subsection is private executive commission complaint. This subsection is paragraph 6 on so forth. The word prosecutor has been inserted by your reporter in place of the model field code phrase engaged promiscuously in sexual relations with others. Is there a definition of prosecutor?
No, it's not defined in the regulation. We have defined it.
We have defined it in the prosecution article.
Yeah, prosecutor is defined in a separate article, but not in this article itself. But now, if you look on page 7 at the commentary, I think it's being some help to your audience. That the article is designed to protect the immature, and that to be realistic, the article must allow some flexibility in the assumption of immaturities based solely on age. A minority of American jurisdictions have rejected the traditional common law position that prior unchastity of the female was not a defense to either forceful or statutory rape, and have allowed the virtue or character of the girl to be an issue in such cases. And then a quote from the Model Penal Code section is set out. Look at the last sentence, quote, the draft, while rejecting the concepts of virtue, chastity, or good repute, permits the defense that the girl is a prostitute.
Where are you reading?
It's on page 8.
Yeah.
And the last sentence in the quoted chapter. The reporter goes on to say this subsection recognizes the defense when the victim is an underage prostitute whose lack of consent is based solely on the fact of legal incapacity to consent to sexual activity because of age. The term prostitute is used in place of sexually promiscuous. Since prostitute is a recognized status in the present law, it will be defined in the article dealing with public indecency, whereas sexually promiscuous is a vague concept likely to result in inconsistent verdicts. Sexually promiscuous is sufficiently indefinite that it might deter legitimate complaints or lead to unwarranted slanders on the complainant's sex life by a defendant's oath helpers. On the other hand, it is recognized that the defense may be only an illusory protection to the defendant if he is unable to persuade others to acknowledge unlawful sexual relations in open court. Also, it is felt that the term prostitute is preferable in cases where the complainant and defendant have been voluntarily social companions and had engaged in prior sexual relations. In such cases, the real issue is consent. It is more appropriate that the mistake provisions govern such cases than that the complainant's character be injected into the crime. Certainly the intent of the draft is not to zero in on prostitutes and say that it's open season of prostitutes. That's not what we're driving at. We're saying that if you're going to bring in the victim's character at all, that you're going to be limited to the showing that she was a prostitute,
well,
not that she was sexually promiscuous.
It doesn't apply to forcible situations.
No.
Well, not as a practical matter, but if your consent is going to bring up the character, in one case, it's resolved it. It showed that she went up the court.
Well, yeah, I suppose it's going to be certainly be relevant.
I understand that.
But I think you still, if you're going to use prostitute, you're going to have to confine this to a period of time that's reasonably close to the time.
Yeah, you relate to minors.
These are basically the underage situation. This applies to rape. Third and second degree rape.
Well, section 6.
Turn to page 22, you see this applies to rape in the third degree and to rape in the second degree where the female is with less than 14 in the mail is 18 years of age or more. Or worse, if less than 15 in the mail, at least 4 years old would be. Those are the areas where
you're all. But it wouldn't apply to 3-sub-2 in this case. In that case, why age is no entry, no element at all. And I realize it isn't very likely, but I would hate to have a guy charged with something and then be able to negate the charge by simply going back someplace and finding out that 7 years ago and 5 years prior to her marriage, some woman had engaged in prostitution someplace.
And she doesn't find that.
So here's who was out.
Statutory rape.
Well, but he's talking about going to statutory rape here is where the female is less than 16 and the male is 4 years older, or she's less than 14 and the male is 18 now. You're not going to go back 7 years.
No. I'm talking about this optional 7-2 we've got here.
Well, that's out. That's,
no.
That was deleted by the subcommittee.
It's not in.
That's completely the
grammar
and the deletion all of a sudden moved.
Yeah.
Optional.
Section, page 22.
Now
I'm trying to find section 9.
Rape in the third degree is where the female is less than 16, the male is 20. Or more. And are we saying that if a 16-year-old female had been a prostitute sometime, that's an offense?
That he can bring this in as a defense, for sure, yes.
Now, there's a motel case that can be a defense to a murder of a third party.
It is a complete defense, then. You're not just using that as evidence of consent.
No, it's framed in terms of a defense.
You've got a 15-year-old prostitute, it's not going to be statutory rape. That's basically what you're saying.
Right.
I mean, it could be forcible rape, even if she was 15.
If it's forcible rape, then it's under Section 5.
Yeah, if it's forcible rape, it's not going to apply.
Well, hell, you invite every statutory rape defendant to scrape the bottom of the barrel to destroy the character of the girl that maybe when she was 13 and was delinquent. You're going to make a hell of a lot harder prosecution for statutory rape cases because everyone's going to try it.
But you have to prove that she'd been a prostitute prior to the agency.
Yeah, and every damn one of them will try it as hard as they can.
And try to find out how many times
a bunch of guys, they say, I paid her $10.
Of course, if you're talking about statutory rape, she's not very far away from it. She's got a very short period to practice the art. If you're talking about statutory rape,
well, she's got 3-4 years.
Yeah. What is the definition of
prostitution?
Now, like if a girl, when she was 14 years old, accepted a candy bar.
A person who engages in sexual intercourse or deviant sexual intercourse in return for a fee. That's our definition of prostitution.
I just wonder, we haven't uncovered this with a half decent minded girl who's been taking a dime from any kid that had come along. And I wouldn't think that should be any defense whatever.
Number 9 and 10, age, 9 and 2 age, 12, 9.
You know, actually, in a statutory rape situation, someone under 16, we wouldn't be too far off if we said that that was no defense.
That's the law now.
Yeah.
That's the law.
Really?
the only defense you're going to have is the showing of mistake as to age. I think, again, the door's going to be open. It's the same thing we're talking about. Your prior activities, your physical appearance, her approach, I think it all be relevant.
Well,
to showing mistake
of
age.
Of course, now the... it used to be in a statutory rape case. I mean, her reputation, it had nothing to do with it because her consent had nothing. And the woman's prior activity, prior sexual behavior, only went really to her consent. After the forcible rape, of course, it's open to whether or not she consented. But now the Supreme Court, with their, that this can go to her character and truth-telling ability, the door has been open for all practical purposes, even in statutory rape cases.
You mean that's admissible today?
It's going to her
veracity.
To tell the truth, whether she's telling the truth.
It is admissible under that theory.
It's prior charges. Prior charges.
Well, the thing is, it's supposed to be prior false charges. But whenever your evidence shows that she has, whenever you've got physical evidence to prove the rape, other than just her word. Like if you had a doctor examine her, so he said that hymen was broken, or if he found certain, then you have opened the door to prove that it may have been somebody else, and she's not telling the truth.
the ALI approach was this, I think. They felt that it really defeats the purpose of a statutory rape law to say that the victim's, this underage victim's chastity or her social reputation should be allowed to come into the case. But on the other hand, they recognize that there are certainly instances in some areas, a growing number of very precocious 14-year-old girls, 15-year-old girls, who are, in fact, prostitutes, and that they're really the victimizers rather than the victim. And it's they felt that you got some rather strange results, to say the least, to say that you have a 14-year-old prostitute who could successfully prosecute a man for statutory rape. And that's what they were trying to do with this, the application of this in their draft.
Well, in the proposed draft on prostitution and related offenses, prostitute is defined as prostitute means a male or female person who engages in sexual conduct for a fee.
How about Bruce's point, though? Isn't what's going to happen every time we've got one of these cases? The defense is going to try to drag them into the witnesses.
Well, under the existing law, aren't they going to anyway?
No,
because it doesn't matter.
Because it's immaterial, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's immaterial.
It opens the door to the defense. Bringing that stuff in, it just opens it an awful lot wider to just sit there and destroy the girl.
Or the grandmother under 9 or 10, too.
Possibly.
Grandmother in the big prospect of a rape. Might be. Not that this doesn't say much statutory.
This is sexual abuse.
Well,
this is a little bit of a problem. What are you going to do about the B girl? Clip joint. That puts his hand on her knee.
Well, I've got a case right now that I'm prosecuting involving this 13-year-old girl, an older guy that buys her ice cream cones, etc. Various times, might be constituted as a fee rather than some gal getting $5-$10 a day. Later on, that may be a defense for anybody else.
Well, the policy question, which is better? To eliminate the defense of consent to those 16 or under 16, or to permit someone to be prosecuted successfully for having had relations with a prostitute, a known prostitute under 16.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd make a motion. Yeah. I'd make a possible suggestion is that we eliminate subsection 5. references to section 3, 4, and 6, 7, possibly 9 and 10, which is this crime of sexual abuse. That gives the prosecutor some way to control it. Well, I think there's some reason for the sexual abuse, because I think a prostitute could put, they could put people in a very compromising situation. I'm talking, what I'm talking about is the B-girl situation. The guy who puts his hand on her leg and this kind of thing,
falls in her ear.
Yeah. Some dirty old man.
I still have trouble using the where you keep such keeping the definition that's found in another chapter. I think of the NAP case, which is the one that Frank was referring to earlier, when he prosecuted that. And that was a situation where the same person, Uncle Walt, had been in relation with her over a period of time. Each time he would give her a fee for it. It would be 50 cents or a cheap watch or a transistor radio. Definition, she was a prostitute. And the defense side of that. The judge motion for federal acquittal after the state's case in chief.
We've gotten the assuming that we go ahead and leave the state is to age. There's no reason that the state is to age as a defense. That if a 14, 15, 15 year old girl such her activity and the way she's going about it, if in fact she is a prostitute, we're worrying about a guy being charged with the statute of rape by a prostitute, he's going to have a pretty good defense from this reasonably mistaken rape. If she is obviously an 11 or 12 year old girl, whether she's a prostitute or not, I don't see why a guy should have a defense for that.
But wouldn't it be, Frank, a little bit?
It doesn't quite seem right to me for 11 or 12 year old girl to be a prostitute or anybody taking advantage of.
I'm inclined to agree with you, but isn't there an inconsistency? You take a 14 or 15 year old girl, chaste, virtuous girl without any previous experience, buxom, physically matured and developed, who appears to be 18 years of age. In that situation, a man who has relations with her has the defense as to mistake of age under this draft, and he'd be successful in that defense. On the other hand, take a 14-year-old girl, flat-chested little gal that looks 13, who is actually a prostitute. And in that situation, he wouldn't have the defense of mistake as to age, and yet he'd be guilty for having relations with a prostitute in that situation. And in the other one, where he shouldn't, he'd be successful in his defense.
Well,
there's an inconsistency
I
there.
I don't think it is, because I don't think it ought to be a defense.
That's 20 years old, what business he got even the messing around with a 13-year-old girl? She's obviously that young.
Whether she's a prostitute or not.
Yeah, whether she's a prostitute or not.
Well, then the question comes, should we retain the mistake as to age?
That's the question.
Well, we definitely should. I have a 15-year-old girl who professed almost only evidence that the mistake is to age.
They are bikini boppers when they're on the stand.
Mother hubbers.
I personally don't think that we should have either.
You mean leave it as the law is now?
Today.
Well, I think that mistake of age is probably important. But an awful lot of justice is done to this.
I really appreciate that. Well, don't you overcome a lot of that by making your 4 years different? A guy that's 21, 22 years old should be fooling around with a gal that young anyway.
Now, under this draft,
well, I think
it's a lot of
14-year-old girl might look 18 or 20.
Of course, the first case that I think really dealt with this was the people that owned Hernandez, the California case. It was about, what, 65, I think, 1965.
What was the holding? I read it yesterday, but what's the holding of that case?
Well, it allowed for the first time, without any statute to that effect, it allowed for the first time a defense on statutory rape. Reasonable mistake made, yeah.
All right, then I want to come back to what I mentioned earlier. Supposing a 14-year-old or 15-year-old girl who definitely is a prostitute but appears to be younger than she is. Shouldn't the defense be available there?
No.
I
don't think it.
I certainly think it ought to be a defense to 9 and 10. In fact, I'd broaden the defense to 9 and 10.
Sure.
Oh, man. No, I think 9 and 10 is to get at the guy who never seen a woman before, caught her in the street.
Yeah.
And sexual abuse you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real danger there. I think the guy should have a defense. A woman is sexually promiscuous. A woman
doesn't say she's sexually promiscuous. She can be so drunk she doesn't know what she's doing with it. She's physically helpless.
Well, remember, this is sexual abuse. This is not rape.
I'm
this is already contacting the woman.
Yeah, but when
a hand on her's
up on a charge of sexual abuse, she claims that she was physically helpless, and he spends all his time trying to prove that somebody paid her a fee sometime.
Oh, man, I think that thing really opens the door.
It's like the old fraternity house angle.
I think there ought to be a broad defense tonight, broader than prostitute.
Page 45.
Now, if I could get you to
look at. Well, Bob, the woman is drunk herself in a compromising situation in the first place. And some guy comes up and puts a hand on her breast. I think you're going to have.
It's
a very dangerous situation.
They're right from town, they're assaulted.
Yeah.
Oh,
man. And the man can take care of it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, could we take these things one at a time?
Well, before you do that, Don, I think we're very close to a consensus on one thing. Apparently, most of us believe, most of the commission believes, that the state as to age should be a defense.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Here comes the prosecutor.
Here comes the prosecutor.
You've got to prove it.
Yes.
I think with that proviso,
and this is the way the subcommittee felt. We're going to allow this, which is a departure, no question about it, a great departure from our present law. If we're going to allow it, the burden's going to be on the defense, which means, in fact, he's going to have to take the stand, probably.
You've got to remember that we have consent here. Anyway, the feeling that I gather is the majority, where there is consent under 16, that the state as to age should be a defense. But on the other hand,
there's no defense under 12.
Right.
Now, on the other hand, the fact in the under 16 category deal that she is a prostitute should not be a defense.
I want to reserve judgment. Sections 9 and 10 2.
Oh, well, we haven't come to that.
Well, that's part of this defense.
Yeah.
He's got sections 3, 4, 6, 7, 9, and 10. Now, I certainly agree on 3, 4, 6, and 7 that are restricted.
Well, I'm only discussing at this moment 3. Section 3.
Well, the thing that strikes me about it is the subcommittee must have pretty good reason for suggesting this.
At least what they did.
Wally?
Well, we didn't spend a lot of time on what the problem we had was the whole age gambit.
If you think we've got problems now, I only ask you to wait till we get to the 4-year age difference. That's where we spent most of our time. We tried to put the position of a 16-year-old and a 16-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl under our present law. If he's in big trouble, and she's got the whip, the handle end of the whip. We try to destroy some of that, and when they're teenagers in the parked car, not to get so harsh. And then we opened up in a 4-year thing. I don't remember spending a great deal of time. We did feel, and I still feel, that although I agree with several of the comments here, that age, the state of age, certainly ought to be clear, and I think that the prostitute, in some circumstances, and so what my feeling would be, that perhaps Bruce has brought out the statutory rape, perhaps in that category, that whether you are raping a 13-year-old, whether she, if she truly looks 13, if we leave age in, you've always got that to pay. If she truly looks 13, as Bruce says, whether or not she's a prostitute, maybe the dirty old man should not have that opportunity. But rather than rip them out, I'd like to go through them one at a time and see if the consensus is, after we've gone clear through the rape and sodomy, that the habits of the victim have no relationship as far as the forceful matters or the statutory matters. Because we're only talking about the statutory rape in this area. That is, the 15 or under.
Well, that's
there's some good comment on this, I think, on page 6, bottom of page 6 and top of page 7 on the mistake of age question. Now, we've upped the age 12 rather than 10, saying that it was not going to apply under that age. But as you look at the commentary, it indicates that the law in the past has generally been mistake of age, regardless of what the victim looks like, has been no defense. And of course, this has come under a lot of criticism in recent years. And it finally culminated in this People versus Hernandez case in California, where the court recognized the first time this defense. But it points out, the commentary points out, that where the victim is over a specified minimum age, such as 10, in our case we made it 12, as the age of the victim increases, the sexual act begins to lose its abnormality and physical danger to the victim. Bona fide mistakes can be made more easily by men who are not essentially dangerous, where the victim is physically more developed. A person who engages in a sexual act with a consenting adolescent, believing honestly and reasonably that such adolescent was of sufficient age to exercise discretion and judgment in the matter, may be violating social conventions, but such conduct does not betoken any abnormality, nor does it exhibit a dangerous propensity to victimize the immature. Imposing absolute liability on such a defendant would have little deterrent, much less rehabilitative effect. In any event, the trier of fact would make the ultimate decision as to the reasonableness of the offender's belief. To me, this seems a reasonable approach. But there's no question about it. It is a radical departure. But I frankly think this is a...
Maybe there's a question of whether aren't we in reality eliminating statutory rape at age 12 above?
I don't think so. When you take the jury and the presiding judge into consideration.
I don't think so. I think as it has been, the prosecutor would use judgment in prosecuting statutory rape when the count looks old enough to... But you don't. The prosecutor shouldn't have that responsibility.
Okay. I mean, a lot of variation. Like the DA's office in Multnomah County, it depends on who's handling the grand jury.
Yeah.
Well, that can change every 6 months.
A lot of it depends on the aggressiveness of the parents, too.
That's me, too. That's even more true.
Yeah.
No.
defendant to get prior or perjured testimony involving past conduct of the alleged victim, regardless of how long it occurred or what the state of time involved was.
Mr. Chairman, I just, yeah, I think we'd all agree with that.
We solve this problem by going down to sub 6 of the prompt complaint and then specifying that the woman must be prosecuted when it raises the defense within the time notice for making the complaint. This is 3 months of the evidence.
Okay. Oh, all right.
Good. This is my real hang up on this. And I don't want to open the woman to complain because she said, well, I was a prostitute yesterday, but I changed my mind last night, and I was going to go straight today, and then this guy did whatever he did.
Mr. Chairman, I'd agree with Mr. Frost and Mr. Chandler in making it a relative period of time, but I don't think I'd go with a prompt complaint because that would be after the fact, I think. She'd have to be a prostitute for 3 months after. I think that perhaps the 3 months before or some relevant period of time would be, because I agree that we wouldn't want to go pick on a grandmother and go back to her teenage life, but we could hone some, make it relevant period of time, because that's what we're trying to get at. I don't think we're trying to prove 80 years ago.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's easy to do that kind of decision. To get it out and open things. I'll make the motion to the strike for reference to 3.6.
Now, what page are
you for? Section 3 is on page 22.
And 7.
Section 4 is on 22. Section 6 is on 34.
I think
7 are all
34.
Statutory. They all involve a 16-year-old or your age, yeah.
How does 4-1 involve everybody?
It isn't
4-1, 4-2. It's only 4-2.
Oh, friendly, 4-2. I got to move from page to page so fast.
Section
4
on page 34.
Well, I think it's a separate question. I prefer to refer to 9 and 10. It's a separate question. I just prefer to divide the questions.
Well, if you want to do that, it'd probably be better drafting, I think, to just strike it completely. And then when we get to those sections, add it to separate.
Also.
You've heard the motion and seconded. Is there any further discussion? The motion is to remove the defense that the victim was a prostitute from sections 3, 6.
Well, Tony, it's all of them, just subsection 5. Delete subsection 5.
You might put all it back in.
All and then put it back in. To delete subsection 5 of section 2. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
I move we renumber subsection 6.5.
All right, there's no objection, that would be done. Subsection 6 would be made sub-5. All right, now where are we?
Well, I think I'm going to take us over to the prompt complaint provisions, sub-6.
So, yeah.
You can't maintain a prosecution under any circumstances unless it's now complained within 3 months, huh? What if you got a case then where you might have a lot of them where the gal never did complain, but somehow the authorities uncovered it 6 months after it occurred? It's something that ought to be prosecuted whether the gal wants to complain or not.
Well, let's take care of last plot,
too.
It is the authorities or the parent, guardian, or other common person, especially interested in the victim.
Learning to the event.
Yeah. Would the district attorney be a competent person, especially interested in the victim?
Yeah.
Would he be especially interested in the victim? That's not the sense of this thing.
Oh, not the victim. He'd be interested in the offense.
Yeah, that's not what that's, I mean, that's not, I don't think you tend to cover district attorneys and that sort of thing. I mean, we're talking about the individuals where the victim is incapable of consenting or complaining herself.
And we're looking at this in the light of the, is the victim that's involved and not the public. The public can be protected whether the victim wants to be or not.
The objection I have is that if there's truly a case where the complaint was claimed wasn't made, it's probably going to be a non-prosecutable case anyway. And I suspect this is unnecessary. If you get into situations where both parents agree to the conduct, it's covered up for a long time, and somehow, in some manner, it gets the welfare authorities, and welfare authorities, or juvenile court authorities find out that this has been going on. Parents combined, I got trouble.
Well, you can get for some states to spend an extended period of time and get to a group making a complaint for an 11-year-old be raped, and then 16, which you have 3 months after reaching 16 to file their own complaint.
What's the real reason for this subsection anyway? You've got a lot of cases where you'll have a guy who'll have multiple rapes. That's probably the biggest crime that's not reported. And you'll investigate one and you'll go back and you'll find two or three others. And if you can't prosecute the one you located the guy on, maybe you got 1 4 months before you can prosecute. When you're able to dig the gal up and then talk to her, and then she's willing to talk to you, but most times these gals won't come in and complain.
The lack of complaint still goes to the consent. I mean,
what's the present statute of limitations?
What?
Three years.
3 years.
The comment on this is on page 9.
Well, but how is this question raised and by whom is it decided? Who has the burden of proof? Those are questions.
This amounts to a statute of limitations.
Well, but how do you decide this? Because it's when you're a question of
authority, not when you file a complaint.
This attorney might have to allege.
Is it a matter that the state has to prove, or does the defense have to prove it? Does the jury decide it? Does the court decide it? These are all factors.
This would be admissible on evidence to test the veracity of the witness, find out if the complainant didn't like it.
It is now.
Just under the rules of evidence.
the rationale, the model penal code rationale, was that this long a period, except in the case of children or immature or some other reason why the victim's incapable of complaining, suggests strongly that there was consent to the act.
And suppose the girl was pregnant. Suggests strongly, and it does today suggest very strongly that there was consent.
Unless there are other circumstances.
Or take that right away from the jury to decide.
Well, one of the things I think we're overlooking that we spent quite a bit of time on is the subtle factors involved here. Saying that the woman, she's waited 6 months and then maybe the jury won't choose to believe her, is ignoring the fact that all during the 6 months she has a threat over this guy and whether or not she's going to go down. He had intercourse with her 3 months ago, and she said, well, you know, you keep under her own damn complaint. And it's one thing for us to say, well, that's an evidential question in the jury, but it's another thing when you're talking about a guy in the community that's going to be charged with rape.
Well, what about the statutory rape case that the girl doesn't say anything to the parents or anybody else, and she gets pregnant and isn't discovered for 4 or 5 months?
Well, of course, the statutory rape, when she gets pregnant within 3 months after a parent or guardian knows or learns, that's all right, the thing that bothers me. I'd like to see some limit. Because although bring up practical matters, how it works. I just think a citizen who reads the statute, not knowing what the points are that Judge Byrne just raised, how they work. And it seems to me there is a problem. Possibility of long time blackmail, unless you put in a pretty short limitation on the time people got to complain.
Isn't that taken care of in the coercion statute?
Or the possibility that
occur also to threat of prosecution.
Or the possibility that somebody can trigger
extortion.
We've got
nothing that we have will prevent the perjury.
No, except if you give a shorter length of time on the thing, you're not making it possible for somebody to come in and say, well, unless you buy me an ice cream cone, I'm going to complain that 2 years and 9 months ago to the assessors.
Well,
of course,
how about 1 year statute of limitations?
I think it's 3 months is very realistic.
Well, I can remember a case of a guy named Mark Broom, who was a Sunday school teacher in the Apostolic Faith Church in Dallas, who had convinced these gals that it was a Christian thing to do to have intercourse with. And that went on over a period of probably some years. It was the only time he got onto it when I was prosecuted over there, put him away and would be victim criminalized because he had some prior convictions before he got religion.
I'm bothered about this possibility that was raised a little while ago about the person's interest in the victim